Goedenavond allemaal, welkom allemaal. En dat is het laatste Nederlandse woord wat valt. From now on it will be in English. Good evening and welcome to you, Mr. Cornell Brookes, President and 18th CEO of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the foremost organization for the defense of the interests of African Americans and other minorities in the US of A. And also welcome to you, Mr. Janice Brookes and Mr. Kevin Turner. The NAACP is at this moment one of the most important bulwarks against the ongoing attacks upon democracy, the rule of law, and social and economic opportunity in America. These are hard times. In politics, you win some and you lose some. In the past few days, you in the US, you won some. The preservation of Obamacare for the time being. And we, Social Democrats here in the Netherlands, we sure lost some in the elections. But we have a century-old history of struggle, and we are accustomed to think in the long term. And so are you at the NAACP, which was founded more than a century ago in 1909. It has seen enormous accomplishments after quite a few setbacks. And right now, it is fighting even harder to safeguard what has been achieved and to accomplish what remains to be achieved. Cornell William Brookes once called himself a heir of the landmark Supreme Court decision of 1953 that imposed racial integration in American schools and thus allowed African Americans, in principle, the same educational opportunities as everyone else. Mr. Brookes went on to earn advanced degrees in political science and divinity, that is, theology, and went on to study at Yale University, serving there as senior editor of the Yale Law Journal and earning a doctorate in law, just by the way, like Barack Obama did at Harvard. In his subsequent career, Mr. Brookes used his legal skills in a number of positions to fight discrimination and secure the civil rights of tenants, nursing home inhabitants, women and minority owners of small businesses, defendants, prison inmates and parolees. And Cornell Brookes did so as a federal trial attorney and as a senior special counsel to the Federal Communications Commission and as a director of the Office of Communication Business Opportunities and as the president and CEO of the New Jersey Institute for Social Justice just before he accepted leadership of the NAACP in 2014. Under the guidance of Cornell Brookes, the NAACP has remained as militant as ever and helped to build decisive support for a number of reforms in education, in criminal justice, for voting rights, and for the fight against police brutality and discriminatory practices. Moreover, the NAACP is right now expanding its activities at the branch level and in the social media at a spectacular rate, and its membership is growing fast. In fact, you too can become a member. You don't have to be colored to join. You don't even have to be rich. It takes a mere $30 by credit card on their website. And it might be a good idea, not just in order to support the good cause, but also to learn a thing or two about the way they over there fight the good fights. If Donald Trump and Geert Wilders, or Marine Le Pen for that matter, can be such great buddies, the time has also come for democratic and progressive forces on both sides of the Atlantic to make common cause. And now, Mr. Brooks, you will understand how glad we are that you've agreed to come and speak to us. Will you please take the floor?
Good evening. It would be hard for me to overstate how happy and delighted and honored I am to be here in Amsterdam this evening. Amidst all that is going on in the United States in the wake of this peripatetic and energetic president we have, it's a welcome relief to be here in Amsterdam. First of all, let me just begin by thanking the Den Uyl Foundation for extending to me this wonderful invitation to participate in this lecture. I'd also like to thank Job Cohen, who is I believe has become the unofficial membership chair of the NAACP. That commercial for membership was completely unsolicited, but very welcome. I also want to extend a word of appreciation to Humanity in Action, who worked with the foundation to bring me here. I see a number of fellows in the room, and so I extend a warm word of welcome to you. And to all the citizens, our brothers and sisters in this struggle for democracy, I extend a word of appreciation to you. As a point of personal privilege, I'd like to recognize my wonderful wife of this many years, Janice Broome Brooks, here on the first row. And my colleague, Kevin Turner, who provides security at the NAACP. Now, generally, this means in the United States protecting me from unknown dangers posed by white nationalists and the Ku Klux Klan. Here in Amsterdam, his job has been protecting me from wayward bicyclists. I believe that the cyclists in Amsterdam are taking their cues from the cab drivers in New York City. Tonight, I take note of the fact that we are gathered in this beautiful church. A secret house, as it were. And that reminds me of a story that causes me to appreciate being in the midst of this very distinguished and august group of people. I can think of a time many years ago as a young seminarian. I found myself in London, England on a Sunday morning. I found myself in London, England on a Sunday morning standing outside of this beautiful Gothic cathedral with spires soaring up toward the heavens, stained glass windows reflecting the iridescent, multicolored, multi-hued beauty of God. And as a young, innocent, naive, presumptuous preacher, I assumed that there were about 2,000 or so people inside this church waiting to hear this young, naive, presumptuous preacher preach. I made my way into the sanctuary and immediately noticed the obvious. The pastor and exactly two members. One member I'll call Miss Jones. The other member I'll call Miss Smith. Now, I did as I was taught to do, which is to say that you speak, you share, you speak, you preach to two people in the same way that you would to 200 or 2,000, with sincerity, with conviction, with a sense of one's calling and purpose. Now, I made my way into the pulpit, and I began to speak, and I immediately noticed the obvious, that Miss Jones immediately fell asleep. True story. Now, this only inspired me to speak with greater conviction and greater utterance and to be more emphatic and enthusiastic in my proclamation. And as I was preaching, I immediately noticed the obvious that Miss Smith seemed to hang on to every word I had to say. She nodded her head, she tapped her toes, she clapped her hands, she said amen and hallelujah at all the right liturgical, theological, and doctrinal moments. And I thought to myself, at least I'm reaching one somebody this Sunday morning. Well, I concluded my little homily, made my way to the side of the pastor, and the pastor said to me, "Brother Brooks, I'm just so sorry. Miss Jones falls asleep on everybody. And Miss Smith is out of her mind and did not understand the thing you had to say." So you can see why I'm just so delighted to be here in Amsterdam amidst this august and distinguished audience, all wide awake and presumably in your right minds. Tonight, we gather at an anguishing hour of our democracies worldwide. We gather at an anguishing hour of democracy in which we see in cities around the globe a millennial generation of activists asserting with their minds, with their bodies, with their very being, that black lives matter. They assert that black lives matter as the ethical premise to the moral conclusion that all lives matter. Unless the first is true, the second can never be true. It is an anguishing hour of our democracy when we realize that we have millennials who, with great courage, with great fortitude, with great discipline, are standing in the streets and giving effect to the words of William Shakespeare, "Now is the winter of our discontent." It is an anguishing hour of our democracy where we see around the world populist movements that exclude, populist movements that demean, populist movements that degrade. We see in the United States of America a campaign in which our republic felt at moments where racism was regularized, anti-Semitism normalized, Islamophobia de-exceptionalized, and misogyny mainstreamed. It is a moment in our democracy where so many feel excluded, so many feel put upon, so many feel as though they are standing on the outside. In America, it is a moment where millions upon millions stand symbolically on the marble steps of the Supreme Court on the outside looking to the inside of this temple of democracy, even as we see an unrelenting surge of voter suppression from one end of the republic to the other. It is an anguishing moment of democracy where so many feel beset by cynicism and pessimism and skepticism. It is a moment of democracy in which the history of the NAACP resounds and reverberates down the corridors of time, reminding us that all is not lost, that we can, in fact, stand for our values. We can stand for one another. We can stand together, we can hold on together, we can love each other, and we can be citizens of the republic together. It is a moment of our democracy where we have activists who are millennials, who are saying to pre-millennials, that would be many of you of a certain vintage, that you cannot outsource this Twitter age civil rights movement to the next generation saying, "I've done enough." This is a moment in democracy where literally we have to learn from one another, share with one another, engage with one another in order to ensure that our rights exist and that our rights are protected and that our rights are made real for the next generation. This is a moment where if we turn the gilded pages of the NAACP's history, we find certain lessons that speak to not only the heart, but also the head, the mind, and the mindset and the mood of this Twitter age civil rights movement. There are three areas in which I think our history is instructive. Certainly we can talk about elections. We can talk about voting rights reform, and we can talk about criminal justice reform. When we think about the election that we have just come through in the United States, this election took place in a certain context. It took place in the context of economic anxiety. That is to say, income inequality on one side and income variability on the other. It's not merely a matter of the poor not having as much wealth as the very rich. It's also a matter of the poor, the near poor, the middle class, and the working class having their incomes be so variable, so unpredictable, so unsustainable that they cannot predict their well-being from month to month. They cannot ensure that their children will have the same lifestyle and security that they had and that they hope for the next generation to have. This election took place in a moment in America where fears and apprehension and trepidation about the role of the other, as in immigrants and refugees, came to the fore. But I want to say to you that the history of the NAACP is instructive here. So when we think about the rise of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s, when the Ku Klux Klan rose from a relative handful to over 2 million members in but a few years. When we think about the rise of the Klan, this racialized terrorist organization in the Deep South and the Midwest that led to the growth of the NAACP, this Klan came into being as a consequence, the 1920s Klan came into being as a consequence of a wrong-headed patriotism, a misguided sense of Christianity, what our president would call 2 Corinthians Christianity, pun intended, and an anxiety and fear about immigrants in America. Note the comparison between the rise of the 1920s Ku Klux Klan and the rise of Trumpism post-millennium. The same misguided emphasis on wrong-headed religion, the same emphasis on a shallow patriotism, the same emphasis on the fear of immigrants. How did the NAACP respond to this challenge? We responded to the challenge by making our values clear. Making our values clear, we made it clear that we stood for the best of America's values. We made it clear that we were, in fact, patriotic. We made it clear that our activism, our social justice aspirations come out of our faith and are not ancillary to our faith. We took the Klan on. We took on lynching day in and day out, decade in and decade out, at great risk to our lives. In the NAACP headquarters in New York City, whenever a person was lynched, we hung a flag out as a piece of pre-Twitter technology. And the flag simply read, "A man was lynched yesterday." The point being here is when you deal with anti-Semitism, with xenophobia, with racism, you cannot afford a policy of moderation. You can't afford a policy of compromise. You can't afford to take a side road. You must take the road that lies right ahead, and you must attack hate in your midst. Where you have Since Election Day in America, over 1,000 hate crimes. According to the FBI's hate crime report, crimes against Latinos up over 5%. Against African Americans up over 5%. Crimes against Jews over 5% increase. But crimes against Muslims up 67% as of December before the election. And these hate crimes that have taken place since the election have not taken place in bars, have not taken place in the streets, have taken place in the main in our K-12 schools. Why? Because the children are emulating the bad conduct of the adults. This is a moment where we cannot afford a policy of appeasement. We cannot afford a policy of timidity. We cannot afford a policy of retrenchment. We have to stand tall on our values and sacrifice for our values and take our fight to the enemy. This does not mean that we don't seek to expand. This does not mean we don't seek to bring others into our work. This does not mean that we don't build broader coalitions. This does not mean that we don't seek to bring others into the camp. But we cease to be effective. We cease to be compelling. We cease to be persuasive when, in fact, we don't stand for what we claim to stand for. You cannot confront the politics of hate with the politics of fear. When confronted by the politics of hate, we cannot respond in a fearful, timid, shy, flat-footed fashion. We have to take our assault to the enemy. The NAACP, when you look across its history, we have been unrelenting in our attack on racism. Take note of this. When we came into being in 1909 as a consequence of a race riot in Springfield, Illinois, in which two elderly men were killed, one of our first pieces of legislation introduced into the Congress in 1912 was a piece of legislation designed to combat lynching. We fought against lynching for well over 30 years and never, never succeeded in passing the federal legislation against lynching that we intended. But we brought lynching to an end by persuading the public, by using the rule of law, by using the Department of Justice, by being unrelenting in our efforts at the grassroots level. When you have 2,200 branches in all 50 states of the country, in every large city, hundreds and hundreds of small towns, Native American reservations, 60 military installations, 5 abroad in colleges and in high schools, when you have an army of activists who understand that the fight cannot be outsourced to lobbyists, the fight cannot be outsourced to the Senate, the fight cannot be outsourced to the House of Representatives, the fight is your fight, and when the fight belongs to the people, they own the fight, and you have the ability to endure and to grow. Key. And so when we consider what we've come through in this last election, we understand that this is a moment of opposition, but it is also a moment of affirmation. That is to say, in our opposition to the things we disagree with, for the things that violate our values, we have a tragic opportunity to affirm our values. So in other words, the election of Donald J. Trump is a defining moment for the NAACP, and I would like to believe that these populist, rightist, extremist movements also represent a defining moment for democracy, a defining moment for those of us who share progressive values to expand, to grow, to deepen our support. It is such a moment. Second area. Let's look at policing in the United States. A few years ago, Trayvon Martin lost his life to George Zimmerman in Florida. A few years later, Michael Brown lost his life in Ferguson, Missouri. Eric Garner in Staten Island, New York. An Afro-angelic young man by the name of Tamir Rice, 12 years old, lost his life in Cleveland. Over and over and over again, we have seen over the course of the last 2 years in the United States the tragic loss of black and brown lives. But as the NAACP has attested to in our reports, a report that I commend to your reading called Born Suspect, this is not merely a black problem, not merely a brown problem, but it is also a LGBTQ problem, also a Muslim problem, in that we have communities of color, communities of faith that are profiled in our cities. And that is can be empirically described in terms of the loss of black and brown and LGBTQ lives. When we think about the fact that a young black man is 21 times more likely to lose his life at the hands of the police than his white counterpart, then it can truly be said that Black Lives Matter is a moral affirmation, but not an empirical description. And so we, in the midst of this policing crisis, we have literally taken our fight to the streets. In Ferguson, Missouri, when a grand jury, failed to return an indictment against Officer Wilson, the NAACP did not choose to wring its hands. The NAACP did not slip into a pessimistic or cynical funk. The NAACP informed the governor that we were going to march from the home of Michael Brown to the home of the governor, 134 miles through an ice storm, through a snowstorm, through an ambush by the Ku Klux Klan. And when we got to the governor's office, we told him that we want you to pass a law against and putting a cap on municipal fines. Fines. Michael Brown was picked up. Why? Was he suspected of rape? Robbery? Murder? No. Jaywalking. And in Ferguson, Missouri, at the time, there was an unholy trinity in existence. That is to say, City Hall, the municipal courts, and the police department, where the police department would pick up black and brown youth, subject them to fines, and those fines were then used to subsidize City Hall. That is to say, predatory policing and predatory taxation were indeed connected. The NAACP told the governor, we need a cap placed on municipal fines. As a consequence of that protest, as a consequence of demonstrations in the streets by the NAACP and so many other groups, that law was passed. But not only that, take note of this. The only point of accountability in the wake of Michael Brown's death was the pattern and practice investigation brought by the Justice Department, the pattern and practice report issued by the Justice Department, the pattern and practice settlement crafted by the Justice Department. But ask yourself this question, how did that happen? It happened as a consequence of evidence derived from statistics mandated by a law that the NAACP wrote. We didn't depend on Congress. We didn't depend on lobbyists. We depended on carpenters. We depended on teachers. We depended on police officers. We depended on firefighters. We depended on the rank and file citizens of our country to fight for racial justice. And in that instance, we won. I believe that this is a moment for us to expand and grow. In the wake of these tragedies where ordinary people have shown up in extraordinary ways, we have literally seen over and over again NAACP branches growing in membership, and growing in membership not just among the old, but among the very young. We have seen college chapters open up again and again across the country. We have seen month over month membership increase by 150%, by 200%, gaining 70,000 plus Twitter followers in a matter of days. We have seen literally ballot initiatives and petitions grow by the hundreds and thousands when we put our bodies, our hearts, and our minds on the line. This is critically important. This is not a moment for retrenchment. This is a moment to affirm our values. And it's a moment for us to use our history in ways that speak eloquently and compellingly to this generation that attracts them to our movement. Let me give you an example. When we say to young activists, we understand this era of mass incarceration. We understand this ugly infrastructure of exclusion, these collateral sanctions that keep so many with criminal records from working in the U.S. We understand that there are 2.2 million Americans behind bars, 1 million fathers behind bars, 70 million Americans with a criminal record, a generation of young people who've grown up with their mothers and fathers behind bars. We understand that the struggle you face now, the struggle you're engaged in now, is related to the struggle of your grandparents. We tell them of the story of a law enforcement officer in Alabama who found two photographs at the bottom of a musty box. One photograph, or two photographs, from yesteryear, a black and white photograph of a time gone by, a sepia-toned picture of a bygone era. One photograph depicted a beautiful middle-aged woman whose shy demeanor disguised a fierce sense of determination. And yet that photograph was scarred like the grime of graffiti on a wall with these numbers: 7053, 7053, 7053. Next to that photograph was a photograph of a young man possessing a precocious sense of moral gravitas and a ministerial bearing. And yet that photograph was disguised, or disfigured, if you will, with these numbers: 7089. 7089. We don't know the middle-aged woman by the number 7053. We don't know her by her arrest number. We don't know her by her mugshot number. We don't know her by her criminal record number. We know her by the name the school children the world over call her, Mrs. Rosa Louise Parks. We don't know the young man by his criminal record number. We don't know the young man by his mugshot number. We don't know the young man by his arrest number. We know him by his given name, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We say to this generation, your struggle is related to the struggle of your grandparents. Your cause is as legitimate, as compelling, as persuasive as the cause of a day gone, of days gone by. We say that this movement for black lives is related to the civil rights struggle. We say that this moment in time, as difficult as it is, as tragic as it is, as challenging as it is a moment for us to rise to the occasion and to speak powerfully and compellingly and eloquently to the call of history, and for us to rise up and grow. But it is a moment for us to literally embrace this generation. We have to be very clear. We cannot grow by repeating platitudes of post-retirement age. We don't grow and expand progressive movements by preaching and teaching ourselves. It means that we have to literally embrace old values and new technology. When we took on the nomination of Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, when the NAACP opposed his nomination to serve as Attorney General of the United States, we did so based upon his long prosecutorial record of standing against voting rights. We did so as a consequence of him affirming the federal expansion of stop and frisk, that same odious policy that has led to the criminalization and the demoralization and dehumanization, if you will, of a generation of young people in our cities. We went to his office in Mobile, Alabama, a small state conference of the NAACP. We went with the head of our youth and college division at the ripe old age of 25 and college students. And we went to his office and we conducted an old-fashioned sit-in. But our young people encouraged us to put it on Facebook Live and on Twitter and on Instagram and on Periscope and on CNN's Twitter feed of 32 million. And so we took this old-school civil rights, civil disobedience tactic and combined it with some post-millennium technology. And as a consequence, we were able to generate a real response among the American public, so that when we testified against Senator Sessions before the Senate Judiciary Committee, we then were able to shut down the phones to the Senate. We were then able to use that moment to teach the country about voter suppression, teach the country about the fiction of voter fraud, teach the country about the realities of racial profiling, reach out and expand the family of the NAACP. What I'm trying to share with you this evening is, again, this is a moment for us to expand, to grow massively, and to do so with a boldness. Last point here. Let us consider the challenge of voting rights. Let me share with you that this matter of voting rights in the U.S. is a matter of personal interest. My grandfather, the Reverend James Edmund Prelow, used to tell me stories as a young man. My grandmother would send me down to his barbershop to get my hair cut, not because he was a particularly fashionable barber, but because it was free. And I would sit in my grandfather's chair, and he'd tell me these wonderful stories about his activism as a local president of the NAACP. I didn't believe him. Many years later, I found myself at Yale Law School, and several of my classmates were handing around a book of vintage photographs of African Americans. And in this book, I saw a picture of a distinguished young man, and beneath the picture was the name, the Reverend James Edmund Prelow, candidate for Congress in the 6th District of South Carolina. What I didn't understand at the time, and what I came to understand later, was that my grandfather ran for Congress in 1946 in the wake of the Smith versus Allwright Supreme Court decision, where Thurgood Marshall argued before the United States Supreme Court that the all-white Southern Democratic primary that excluded blacks from the democratic process, excluded blacks from the electoral process, was in fact unconstitutional. He won that case in the Supreme Court, but Thurgood Marshall was not content to merely be an exemplary constitutional litigator. He actually went out into the churches, actually went out into the communities, actually went out into these small towns all across South Carolina, and he talked about not only the constitutional significance and the constitutional importance of the right to vote, but he talked about the importance of ordinary people standing up for the right to vote. And as a consequence of his talk, as a consequence of the eloquence of his example, my grandfather ran for Congress in spite of the Klan, in spite of the racial vigilantes and the racial terrorists of the time, and the district in which he ran. Let me take note of this. He didn't run as a consequence of advice from Fox News. He didn't run as a consequence of the commentary of CNN, did not run as a consequence of great polling numbers. He ran because he wanted to encourage people to vote and to join the ranks of the NAACP. That seat that he ran for and lost massively in 1946. But that seat was occupied by Congressman James McMillan, who stood against D.C. statehood, stood against D.C. home rule year after year after year. This is the same congressman who sent a watermelon to the first black mayor of D.C. But the seat and district in which my grandfather lost, the 6th District of South Carolina, is now occupied by the former head of the Congressional Black Caucus, James Clyburn. He didn't win in his lifetime, but he won in his legacy. And so when I think about what my grandfather went through, I think about the voting rights challenges of my time. We saw in the wake of the Shelby versus Holder Supreme Court decision, nothing less than the Machiavellian frenzy of voter disenfranchisement from one end of the country to the other. We saw in Texas them pass a voter suppression law that required a government-issued photo ID. Now, this on its face would seem not entirely unreasonable, except They accept it as a form of ID, an ID which allows you to carry a concealed weapon, a handgun, a shotgun, an assault rifle. Those IDs were deemed sufficient civic and democratic proof to vote. But an ID which allows you to carry a book of English, a book of chemistry, a book of engineering, a college textbook was deemed to be insufficient civic and democratic proof to vote. In the wake of that Shelby versus Holder Supreme Court decision over in the state of North Carolina, they passed a voter suppression law, which meant that if you had an ID which allowed you to walk across the campus of Camp Lejeune or Fort Bragg, it was deemed sufficient civic and democratic proof to vote. A military ID was deemed to be okay. But an ID which allowed you to walk across the campus of Duke University, North Carolina State University, or UNC Chapel Hill was deemed insufficient civic and democratic proof to vote. But here's what we found, and here's what we did. The NAACP went to court in Texas, and we saved 630,000 votes. We won in court. Not just the lawyers winning, but ordinary people winning. We went to court in the Fourth Circuit, and we won and saved the imperiled votes of 5% of the electorate. Let me share this with you. And what have we seen? We have literally seen ordinary people who are not members of the Supreme Court bar join the NAACP. This is a moment where we understand that if we are going to define the trajectory of our country, it means that we have to quite literally protect the right to vote. But not only that, we have to take a page from our European brothers and sisters in terms of modernizing the vote. We don't have automatic registration. We have this cacophonous patchwork of voter laws in the U.S. designed to suppress the vote. You don't have early voting. You don't have automatic registration. Voting is made difficult. It is made cumbersome. It is made inconvenient to keep people from voting. But we believe that if we modernize the vote, if we protect the right to vote, and we can usher in and invite in a diverse, younger electorate, our progressive values can be ensured for a generation. Why? Not because demographics are, in fact, destiny, but demographics are indeed directional. If we can expand our movement, and this is the time to do so, what we know is this. Over the course of the NAACP's history, when we have taken on these fights for voter rights, we have seen an uptick in voting. It's not always secure, it's not always stable, but what we know is this. This is a fight that provides for us a tragic opportunity to do more than we have ever done. It is a moment in which the NAACP and similar organizations literally have to engage in movement building. But I want to suggest to you that this is not a fight that is to be confined to the U.S. I'd like to suggest to you the progressive values that we are seeking to vindicate around the world. I'd like to suggest to you that the values that we share, the values that go back and forth across the Atlantic and back and forth across the digital space, are values that we can put into place. Some of the strategies that work in one context can work in another context. Here's what we know. We know that this movement for Black Lives, we know that these millennial movements do not have borders. We know that young people are sharing ideas, sharing strategies, sharing policy across the digital space. We know that this technology is a means of inclusivity. Think about this. When Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson, a group of teenagers took their cameras and their mobile devices, and they took pictures of his lifeless body on that sidewalk for nearly 4 hours. They took those pictures, they took those images, and they transported them around the world via geostationary satellites and fiber optic cable and devices of every known quantity and variety. And as a consequence of their digital advocacy, as a consequence of their global conversation, they literally put the words Mike Brown on the lips of Barack Obama in Geneva, Switzerland. And so when we think about what they are doing with this technology, let us remind ourselves that in Montgomery, Alabama, there was a piece of pre-Twitter technology understood and known as the mimeograph machine. That there were African-American women who took that mimeograph machine and they literally cranked out tens of thousands of flyers that made that boycott possible, that made the constitutional litigation successful, and literally as a consequence of Rosa Parks sitting down, that caused a nation to rise up. I want to suggest to you right now that it's not the technology, it's the people behind the technology. If we use social media, understanding that social media does not mean social as in digital. It means social as in voting. It means social as in organizing. It means social as in mobilizing. It means social as in movement building. Social as in literally reforming, expanding, and growing our movements around the world. If millennials are doing what they do with what little they have, why can't we do more with all that we have been given? This is such a moment. And so when we read the election returns, this is not a cause for clinical depression. When you're a member of an organization that is 108 years old, when you've seen presidents elected on a platform of racial terrorism, when you have seen Reaganomics and Trumpism, when you've seen the Vietnam War and the Iraq War, when you have seen as a consequence of your activism and the mobilization of 1.1 million citizens through the voting rights, and rather I should say the voter registration and the voter mobilization efforts of the NAACP, when you have seen that and you've seen the nation's first African-American president elected and reelected as a consequence of your advocacy, this is not a moment for us to be despondent. It's a moment for us to organize. It's a moment for us to mobilize. It's a moment for us to network. It is a moment for us to rethink, re-engineer, and reimagine the way we do advocacy and the way we do mobilization. The NAACP is a non-partisan organization, but we're not a non-issue organization. We're not a non-political organization. We're not a non-aspiration organization. We understand that parties are part of the solution. And so we simply want to say to you from where we stand, yes, this election has been difficult. Yes, this election has been challenging. Yes, the challenges seem like they come on every side, every day by the tweet. That said, this is a moment, the likes of which we have not seen in our lifetimes. When we consider in the last election, certainly in the U.S., where we saw generationally unprecedented activism, and yet anemic voter turnout. It said to us that we've got to connect protests, policy, the polls, and pop culture. Let me be clear on that. We've got to connect protests, policy, polls, and pop culture. We understand as a matter of strategy, you cannot have activists in the streets and in Twitter sphere without having them at the ballot box. We understand that we have got to also connect them with policy. That means if we have activists who are brave, we certainly believe that if you're brave, you can also be brilliant. And that means that we have to share the policy prescriptions that we have with every generation. But going beyond that, it has to be connected with a civic mobilization strategy. In other words, we've got to ensure that every protester is a voter, every voter is a protester, and we've got to turn them out to vote. Lastly, I want to note here, we have to understand the power of pop culture and the power of media. It is no accident that we asked Chance the Rapper, as in Grammy Album of the Year, Artist of the Year, to head up our Stay Woke and Vote campaign. It's no accident that he was able to register 1,000 young people a night with the NAACP. It's no accident that one of our leading cheerleaders on criminal justice reform is John Legend. we make it a point to partner with those who want to partner with us in the work, but who understand that unless we arrest the people's attention, we're not going to get them arrested, as in civil disobedience. This is that kind of a moment. And may I share with you that I'm excited about the Progressive Project, progressive movements, and certainly the work of the NAACP. I'm enthusiastic about it. I believe that this is a rare and unprecedented, even if it's a tragic, opportunity. I believe that this is a moment for building. And may I share with you why I so believe that this is our time. 2 years ago, the NAACP announced what we called America's Journey for Justice. We announced a march from Selma, Alabama, to Washington, D.C., a geographic span of 1,002 miles. The purpose of this march was to build support for the right to vote, to build support for our voter mobilization effort, to build support for our voter mobilization and our protect the vote efforts on the ground, even as we endeavor to educate a generation as to what all this meant. So we announced what we called America's Journey for Justice, this march over the course of 43 days, five states, three red states, two purple states, and one blue district of Columbia, across the state of Alabama, across the state of Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, into D.C. So we announced this march. We started in the hometown of the Voting Rights Act, Selma, Alabama, marching toward Washington, D.C. When we started off in Selma, Alabama, I met a man whose chosen name was Middle Passage. Middle Passage told us that he wanted to march from Selma all the way to Washington, D.C. Middle Passage, 67 years of age. Middle Passage, a veteran of the Navy, Middle Passage, a veteran of the Vietnam War, told us that he wanted to carry the American flag the entire distance. Middle Passage spent his days talking to college students, to millennials, to high schoolers about the right to vote. Middle Passage formed these relationships between pre-millennials and millennials around the right to vote. Middle Passage helped us teach online and in person about the right to vote. Middle Passage teached and taught by the eloquence of example how and what it is to build a movement. So we marched for 40 days. We came to this little town in Virginia called Spotsylvania. Middle Passage carried the American flag nearly the entire distance. But when we came to Spotsylvania, we walked through a rainstorm. And in that rainstorm, Middle kept the flag wrapped up. But when the rain stopped, when the clouds parted, when the blue sky emerged, Middle unfurled the flag. And when he did so, he literally collapsed to the pavement. My hardest day at the NAACP was telling a group of students, millennials, young people, that Middle didn't make it, that Middle didn't come back from the hospital, that Middle died. But the hardest question I've ever been asked at the NAACP was posed by those same students who asked the question, if a man was willing to die for the right to vote, why can't you vote and fight for the right to vote? When you bring old school energy, old school examples, old school commitment and determination into a new millennial, young, dynamic, energetic movement, powerful things happen. I want to suggest to you that our time is not past. Our time is not over. Our time is now, this moment, this occasion, this Twitter moment. That's the moment we're in. And I want to share with you that if you grow discouraged, there are these words scrawled on a piece of faded manuscript, entombed in the Beinecke Rare Book Library on the campus of Yale University, and yet written on the hearts of millions of members and supporters of the NAACP. The words would be these: lift every voice and sing, till earth and heaven ring. Ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise high as the listening skies. Let it resound loud as the rolling sea. Sing a song full of the faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song full of the hope that the present has brought us. Facing the rising sun of our new day begun, let us march on, let us march on, let us march on, let us march on till victory is won. Thank you.